One of the common concerns we're hearing these days from representatives across Montana and across the U.S. is the increasing need to end the political division between both our elected officials and our fellow citizens in order for the country to move forward. In this edition of the Voices of Montana podcast, guest host and former state legislator Russ Fagg catches up with former Montana Governor Mark Roscoe to chat about his early upbringing as a youth, as an attorney, and as our governor, and also touches on the current path the country is going down regarding political communication and the divisiveness, and what we can do to bridge this ever-widening political divide. This is a fascinating discussion with the former governor that just scratches the surface on all these different topics. You get to hear a little bit of his days on Libby's state championship basketball team, his time working with the state legislature, and other insights you won't hear anywhere else. We call it the fastest hour in radio for a reason, and this episode is a prime example why. So thanks for listening, and enjoy this conversation with Russ Fagg and Mark Roscoe.
Good morning, Montana. This is Russ Fagg, a guest host for Tom Schultz this morning on Voices of Montana. I'm super excited to have former Governor Mark Roscoe on the show with us. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Russ. How are you?
Hey, very, very well. Thank you for joining us this morning. So many of you will remember that Governor Roscoe was the former Attorney General, I think, two terms for Montana. Then he was a former governor for two terms in Montana. He went on to become the Republican National Committee chairperson under President Bush. I know him as a good person and a man of integrity, and honestly, one of my favorite people that I've had the opportunity to spend some time with over the course of my life in politics. Governor Roscoe, what I'd like to do is just kind of have you remind Montanans where you came from. I understand you're from Libby. Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in Libby? I'd even like you to tell us about your mom and dad, just some of your memories from as a young man.
I'll do my very, very best, Russ. I was born in Thompson Falls, actually. My parents came from Thompson Falls, and they were married and then took off. He was a teacher. He had just graduated from Eastern Washington State Teachers College and had come back and gotten married. And then a year later, he taught during that year in White Sulphur Springs and came back to Thompson Falls, and I was born that summer after they were married. And then ultimately, he went to Miles City, and we were in Miles City for 3 years where my twin brothers were born. And then he had an opportunity after 3 years in Miles City to go back to Libby, which was where he was raised. He was born and raised in Libby. And his parents and his family and, of course, the entire community was involved in logging operations, and his father was a camping cook, a camp cook out about 10 miles from town. They did everything by rail then. So my dad didn't see his father all the time he was out in the camps, unless they got on one of the lumber trains and went out to see him, and then saw him during spring breakup. But anyway, that's how it ended up that we were back in Libby. Was he was offered the job teaching and coaching in Libby, Montana. When I was 4 years old, we moved back to his hometown and went to school there. I mentioned my two twin brothers, and then my brother Patrick was born in Libby, and then I was in school, of course. And after Patrick's birth, that wasn't too long, two and a half years, that it was during the aftermath of the Korean War that there were a lot of children in Korea with American parents that had, there were some, opportunities for them to meet people there. And my brother Philip, who's Korean, was born and in an orphanage, and Catholic Charities was trying to find adoptive homes for these young American children. And so my parents, with four boys already, decided that they would proceed with an adoption. And my brother Philip was adopted and came all the way from Busan, South Korea, to Libby, Montana, if you can imagine.
Wow, what and, a culture shock.
He was just 3 years old, and he was integrated rather rapidly into a household full of four boys that, with twins, my mother had now five boys within 6 years of age of one another. So it was a pretty busy place. And my dad was coaching. And so I went to school there, graduated from there. And then my father, when I was a senior, was offered a position at Carroll College. And he had all these children. And in the interim, we'd had another baby, my brother Chris, in Libby. And then, again, Catholic Charities had a placement that they were hoping to make with a little girl. So we ended up adopting my sister, Amy. And so when I was a senior in high school, we now had six boys and one little girl. And my father was offered a job in Libby, or excuse me, in Helena at Carroll College. And he had all these children. And they made him a deal that if he would come and accept the job, which required a diminution in pay, that his children could go to school without paying tuition.
Terrific.
And so he decided to make the move. We moved to Helena, went to school there, and graduated from there and met Teresa there.
Slow down just a little bit. I want to get to Teresa, but before we do, and I'm doing this from memory, as I recall, weren't you on the state championship basketball team at Libby?
Yes, in 1966. They had converted the classification of teams, if people have a memory as long as mine, and there was a league known as the Big 32, and they had taken the 32 largest schools in Montana and had placed them into one league. And it was the third year of that particular league that was a part of high school athletics then. And so we were one of the smallest, if not the smallest school in the Big 32. And we were at least in our conference. And I know that at the state tournament, we were the smallest school. But I had been fortunately born at a moment when in Libby there were also two twin brothers who were born who were 6'6". And at that time, being that tall was pretty unusual.
Sure.
And then one of our best friends was also about 6'4", 6'5". And then we had a guard who could shoot the eyes out of a basket, my father used to say.
Hmm.
And he was... we took off to the state tournament, and it was quite a journey. It was kind of like the story of Hoosiers. we were incredibly small in our community, but we had a good basketball team. We didn't have TV when we were growing up, so we spent a lot of time playing basketball, baseball, football, whatever season it might be, and we did it almost always together. So by the time we got to high school, we knew each other exceptionally well. We took off to the tournament in Butte, and it was St. Patrick's Day. We were a little bit unfamiliar with the rituals of St. Patrick's Day because there were not that many Irishmen up there in Libby. There
Sure.
were a lot of Scandinavians. And so we arrived there on St. Patrick's Day. We went to the arena and the Butte Civic Center, and, of course, there were more people that could be seated in that facility than lived in the entire Lincoln County. So when it was full, it was something for us to behold. And we ended up playing Lewistown first, and then we played Billings West second, and then we played Belgate High School third, and ended up winning three ball games by, I think it was 7 points.
In total, wow.
Different ball games.
Right.
In total, yeah. So it was quite a fairy tale, Russ. It was something that you know, we always dreamed about but didn't realize we would have the opportunity to participate in.
And you're always
so
modest,
that's
but as
how
I recall,
it unfolded.
Were you the point guard and kind of the leader of the team, as I remember the story?
Well, my... I think that that's a fair characterization. I definitely, my father told me, Mark, you have to remember you're not big, but you're slow. And he was right about that. And I had to, he said, you have to learn different skills. You've got to be a good leader. You've got to be unselfish. You've got to play good defense. You have to set up the remainder of your team to be successful. And, he insisted on that, and he was also an innovator with the game of basketball during those days. We played fast break basketball, so we ran a lot, and we had some quickness. So it worked out that I typically could get people in a good position and feed them a pass, and we had good scores, and we ended up all of us contributing in our own unique ways. And it really was a profound lesson in teamwork that if you do your part, you can bring out hopefully the best in yourself and with those that you are participating with, and ultimately achieve some success as a whole rather than as individuals.
What a wonderful Cinderella story. One of the smallest schools in the tournament, winning the tournament. It gives me goosebumps to even think about it. So let's segue to Carroll. Tell us a little bit about what you majored in. I believe you did some sports in Carroll, and is that where you met Teresa? So kind of walk us through those Carroll college days.
Okay, well, I was at Carroll, and I did play two sports. I played football and basketball, and started on those days that had only freshman teams, and you didn't have freshmen involved in varsity basketball, so I started on the football team and played that season, then went into basketball, and we had a pretty successful season during our freshman year in our freshman league with Montana State, the university, and then all of the schools in the Frontier Conference. And then when I was a junior, Teresa came to school. She had been born and raised in the Lewistown area out in Denton, Montana, which, of course, has experienced such an extraordinary tragedy during these winter months with a horrendous fire. And she went from there. They were a farm family, and they moved from there when she was in elementary school to Big Timber. So she had come from Big Timber to go to school at Carroll, and we met. She was a cheerleader, ultimately we both got involved in student government, and we were friends, and then realized that we had some attraction to each other that was stronger than just friendship. And as a result, when I was a senior, I proposed marriage to her, and then she, thank God, accepted, and we got married the next summer. And of course, we had military obligations then, Russ, and I immediately took off after graduation to boot camp at Fort Knox. I was involved in a program whereby if you went to law school, you could go to boot camp, go through boot camp, and then spend the first 2 years of your law school in an ROTC program, which I did at the University of Montana. And then you would be commissioned into the United States Army on active duty for 4 years as a JAG lawyer. So we had our first child while we were in law school, and then we graduated, went into the Army. We were stationed, they stationed us first at Fort Lewis and then in Germany, in Worms, Germany. And then we had our second child. Tim was born in Heidelberg. And after our completion of our term of service in Germany, then we were, they were, cutting back on the number of armed forces. It was, we went in when Vietnam was still ongoing. As a conflict and a battle for the United States and a lot of people around the world. And by the time that we were there at the end of our tour, the Vietnam War had ended. So they were looking to, shrink the number of troops. And as a consequence, and we had fulfilled our obligation, so we matriculated out of the United States Army, and I had a job waiting for me in Missoula as a deputy county attorney. 6 weeks after we arrived here in Missoula, we had another baby, Mary Catherine. So now we had three. And I was working at the county attorney's office, and they created a special office in the attorney general's office staffed by an experienced trial lawyer that would help county attorneys who did not work full-time. Most of them did not in those days. And there were seven that were full-time, the other 49 were part-time. And so they created this Office of Prosecution Services, And I applied for that job and was selected. And
Governor, this is a great time for a break. We've got a hard break. We'll be right back, and I want to talk to you more about that prosecution services job.
At the University of Montana, students learn as much under the big sky as they do on campus. UM students are tackling invasive species in the Flathead, workforce shortages in Billings, water rights in Great Falls, rural health care in Havre, wildlife in Yellowstone, pharmacy in Forsyth, and education in Alberton. Wherever we are, grizzlies leave their mark across Montana. Learn more at umt.edu. Up with Montana.
Welcome back to Voices of Montana. Russ Fagg here with former Governor Mark Roscoe. Governor, I'm very much enjoying this story. We were just at University of Montana after your JAG Corps service, and we were talking about the prosecution services. Tell us a little bit about that chapter in your life.
Well, the I did have a lot of trial experience in Germany, in the military, Russ, a lot of different cases. And as a consequence, I did probably in minimal fashion qualify for the position. there may have been more experienced lawyers, but ultimately Attorney General Mike Greeley offered me the position. So we moved from Missoula to Helena, and that's where I assumed my duties. And what we were charged with doing was serving as a coordinator for all of the county attorneys in Montana, and then also providing some special prosecution services. Typically in those days, if you had a very serious case and you were a part-time county attorney, there were efforts made to secure experienced counsel on the market. And so private attorneys would come in and be appointed as a special prosecutor and help and assist in trying those cases. That function was moved into the job that I assumed at the Attorney General's office. And one of the very first cases that I ended up being assigned to was in Hardin. And that was the Monty Dyckman homicide case.
Right.
And we spent months, frankly years, dealing with that case. And I worked extensively with Jim Sikora, who was the county attorney then. And then I also presented all of my own appeals to the Montana Supreme Court or to the federal courts if they were appealed. So it was a very active job. It was intensely stacked with cases around Montana. So I got around Montana a lot. And I got to meet so many different people who served as jurors, all of the people who were working in courthouses, all of the law enforcement, city, county, state, FBI, when you were dealing with issues that might focus on the reservation. And as a result of that, it was an extraordinary amount of intense experience in a very short period of time. And I loved the job. I hated being away from my family, but I did love the work and enjoyed the public service immensely. And then I met all of the legislators. Mm-hmm. Who came to town during the legislative sessions, because I prepared all of the legislation for county attorneys across the state and law enforcement in many ways. And as a result, would be testifying for the legislature frequently and presenting bills for their consideration. So that occupied the next 12 years. And it was a joyous, serious, but very productive and felt very meaningful in terms of making a contribution to the best interest of Montana. So I enjoyed it a lot.
So, Governor, as I recall, you went all across the state, tried jury trials, and I remember one of the cases of note was the Mountain Men trial. You prosecuted that case, is that right? The Nichols father-son?
Yes, I did. That was down in Madison County in Virginia City, and it was, it was a historic old courthouse. And, of course, that's where some semblance of law and order began to emerge in our very beginning as a state and a territory. And so it was one of those combination of circumstances no one could write a script for.
Right.
But it ended up being a very, very difficult case. A young man died, of course, and Alan Goldstein, who was trying to rescue Carrie Swenson, who she and her family became very close friends over the years. It wasn't too long ago, just a year or so ago, I had an opportunity to have a conversation with Carrie. But, yes, we spent spent a lot of months. The offense was July 15th, 1984. I'll never forget the date. And we tried the first case. They actually were arrested in December, and we tried the cases in May and June.
Hmm. So, Governor, you've had a storied life, but I know it's not been all a bed of roses. I recall you ran for judge once or twice and was unsuccessful. And I've always thought you learn more from a loss from a win. But can you tell us a little bit about those journeys?
Yes. Well, in 1980, there was a Supreme Court race. And interestingly, I had our family had proceeded with adoptions before a judge up in Kalispell, whose name was Frank Haswell, a wonderful man, mm-hmm. former Marine, an incredibly good and decent fellow. And I was, probably prematurely looking at trying to continue my career in public service. And that particular position, the Chief Justice position, was up for election that year. And there was some public financing that was available for those races, and they were nonpartisan, as everybody knows, I'm sure. But I decided I wanted to pursue a career trying to win a position and serve as a judge in Montana, as you did so ably for so long. But, I was only 32 years old, and frankly, there was absolutely nothing wrong with Frank Haswell's service to the state of Montana. It was exemplary. He was widely revered around Montana. He was very kind to me throughout the course of the election. But as you might imagine, my campaign did not achieve success, and I lost. Nonetheless, I spent about 18 months, and you mentioned something very important. At least it was important to me, and that is the experience of losing taught me way more about myself and about the expectations of the people I wanted to serve than winning ever did. And as a consequence, even though I wasn't successful, I learned an incredible amount of things that were important to the people of Montana, and also got deeper committed into public service. And so I went back to my job. I stayed in my job as I was running. And a position in Lewis and Clark County, a judgeship came open. Again, I was convinced, that's where I needed to be. And so I ran again. And frankly, it was a long campaign. As you know, they're 18 months long.
Sure.
You get in your pickup and you drive to the various communities you serve or want to serve. You meet with the Rotary, with Lions Club. You go any place, somebody will stand still long enough to listen to you and try to convince them to support you. It was the old days of campaigning. There was no internet, and you did a lot of driving and a lot of time by yourself and a lot of time trying to find places where people wanted to hear about what you were doing. But I lost that race as well. And 2 years later, another judgeship came open in Lewis and Clark County. It was a close race. I think I lost the race by about 300 votes.
Okay.
And that particular district served Helena and Broadwater County down in Townsend. So there was not so much time away from home, but a lot of time spent on weekends and evenings going door to door and passing out my literature and talking to the people I wanted to work for. But I lost that race too. And so I was, in the beginning of this political career I was pursuing, Russ, I was 0-3. And
but you learned a lot. Governor, I'm sorry to cut you off. We have a news break we're going to take. I want to be right back and then continue this conversation because I'm very much enjoying it. We'll be right back with Governor Mark Roscoe.
Have you considered joining an organization that offers leadership growth, career development, scholarship opportunities, and competitive events? If so, the Montana FFA is for you. This is Riley Prather, Montana FFA State Secretary from Big Timber. Over 5,300 Montana high school students are taking advantage of what FFA has to offer. Explore what FFA has for you by visiting MontanaFFA.org.
Thanks to Farmers Union Insurance for supporting FFA and this message.
Welcome back to Voices of Montana. Russ Fagg here with Governor Mark Roscoe. Mark, you were just telling us 0-3 is a political start. But it went uphill from there. Tell us about that next chapter.
Well, my my boss, Mike Greeley, the Attorney General, had served three terms and had decided to run for governor. And there were a number of people who came to me, knowing that I'd been involved in political activities in the Republican Party, and wanted to talk to me about running for Attorney General. This was the first time somebody suggested that I might be a candidate rather than me suggesting it to myself. And I honestly, I had voted every year, and I participated in political discussions, and I had not made a decision about whether or not as a candidate I would be a Republican or a Democrat, because I had been pursuing these nonpartisan positions. So I read the platforms of both parties and came to the conclusion that I, in fact, was a Republican, that I believed in the credo of the Republican Party, although I found a favor with many things that Democrats believed in. I thought that if I had to make a choice, I was a Republican, and if I was in a partisan race, I would proceed on a Republican ticket. I had talked to my father about it shortly after I decided to run for that office. My father was diagnosed with an extremely rare but a very lethal form of cancer, and he was very sick. And I talked to him about it, and he said to me, "Mark, I don't understand why you would contemplate this. We've tried three times, and you've lost three times, and it doesn't look like this is what is designed for your life." And I told him, I said, "Dad, I really think that there's a place out there for me someplace, and this is a function in state government that I know exceptionally well. I've been in the office for
Governor, I'm sorry to do it. We have another break that we have to hold, but we'll be back right in a minute with Governor Mark Roscoe. Thank you.
Continues right after this.
I've been shooting since I was young. It's something I've always enjoyed. I wasn't feeling like myself, but my friend noticed. He asked if he could hold onto my guns temporarily. At first, I was a little shocked, but then I agreed. I think he saved my life that day.
Reach the Montana Suicide Prevention Lifeline anytime at 800-273-TALK or text MT to 741-741.
Good morning again. Russ Fagg here with Governor Mark Roscoe. Governor, it truly is the fastest hour in radio. I am very much enjoying your story. You were just talking about your dad, and he was concerned whether you should run for Attorney General. Obviously, you did run, and you won. I want to try to, I know it's 8 years, and it's difficult, but can you tell us some of the highlights, some of the things that you're the most proud of your years as Attorney General for Montana?
Yes. Well, my dad died before I actually went through the election. We won very, very narrowly. And I had been in the department for such a long period of time that there were a lot of things that we wanted to do, reorganize, make ourselves more efficient, you know, to live within our budget limitations, and to be effective in providing services to the state of Montana. So we did a lot of things with the revamp of the Law Enforcement Academy, with the State Crime Lab. We had a group of lawyers who were very, very diligent and effective advocates who argued all of our appeals. So we reorganized those agencies. And over the course of time, I think we served well. And we produced a quality product, I think, for the people of Montana. And as a result of that, I was thinking at the end of that term that I would seek reelection, and did not have an opponent at the time. But that was the moment when Governor Stan Stevens had a heart attack.
Okay. And
as a consequence of that, the possibility of seeking another office was suggested to me rather than the Attorney General's office. And as a result, Teresa and I, after a lot of soul searching and searing scrutiny of our lives, decided that we would take the risk and run for that particular office.
And I, you know, there's so many stories, because I remember that now that you say that, and they were looking for the strongest candidate, and it was pretty clear to a lot of people, including myself, that you were the strongest candidate, but you were a shoo-in for Attorney General, and you were doing a good job there. And as I recall, that was a very difficult campaign for governor against a very formidable candidate in Dorothy Bradley, who is, I know you respect her as I do. and it was a close race, but you did pull that off. Can you, what are your, some of your memories from that, that first governor's race?
Well, first of all, Dorothy Bradley is an extraordinary human being.
Yes.
And an immensely talented woman. And she was a very hard worker and a very, very credible candidate. And she could argue a cause as effectively as anybody on the planet. And so we ended up, I mentioned the other day to somebody that we were involved in 32 different public forums together or debates. Where we appeared side by side and presented our cause to the people of Montana, all over the state of Montana. We ultimately narrowly won by less than a percentage point, is my memory. But my memories of Dorothy are that she pushed you to the limit to perform, and she could outwork you if you let her. And she was just a wonderful human being. And a very, very effective candidate. And so as a consequence, our race, I think, was very elevated. There was no degradation associated with the campaign. There was no slanderous attacks. It was always focused on issues and the power of ideas and about how we would approach executing the office of governor if we were elected. And so at the end of the race, it was neck and neck, and I think it was right around one percentage point that ultimately was the difference. And I was accorded the opportunity to begin service as the chief executive of Montana in January of 2003. So that's how it all started. That's how the campaign went. Dorothy and I are still incredibly good friends to this very day. I still have the same amount of respect and admiration for her. And an affection that has grown over the years.
And Governor, I want to get to how we've lost that civility and the ability to disagree without being disagreeable in a minute. But before we do that, can you talk about some of the highlights of your 8 years as governor, some of the things you're particularly satisfied with?
Well, we in those days, there were a great many very innovative governors. And Clinton was in office, as you remember. He had been a governor for 12 years, and he was very much into looking at, he knew what governors had to do. And frankly, the governors of this country, after the elections are over, serve in a very highly nonpartisan fashion. They have a job of running a government, and it's not full of partisan politics every single day. And he was interested in reshaping a lot of our institutions and our efforts to provide government that was effective as well as inexpensive as it could be. And so we went through welfare reform. We would completely reorganize state government. It remains pretty much in the constellation that it was changed to back when we were in office. And we tried to be as effective in achieving tax reform as we possibly could. Dorothy Bradley and I were both advocates of sales tax in those days, believing that we ought to export some of the costs of our government to those who came to the state of Montana. The people of Montana did not agree with that. So we tried to reform other parts of the tax system, the local tax system, the property tax system, the business property tax. That was the beginning of the elimination of the business tax in Montana. So there were, and just administering government on a daily basis, trying to be responsive to the people who own it, the people that you lived with, the citizens of Montana, and to achieve their confidence. The one thing that I can remember desiring more than anything else was to have the confidence of the people of Montana that we were doing our best, and that even though we may stumble and fall and make mistakes, that we were always proceeding in good faith. And frankly, that's what people did in the legislature. It's what they did in the other offices. You know, I served, Russ, with four other Democrats in the executive offices of Montana, the attorney general, the treasurer, or the auditor, the insurance commissioner, the superintendent, secretary of state. They were all Democrats. And I can remember we entertained 100, this is just one example, 104 different timber sales for state lands when we were all in office. And we unanimously approved because we spent the time to inspect those issues, to go over them, to listen to the environmental interest and to the industry interest. And we, I think, unanimously approved just close to 100 of those timber sales, which reflects the fact that we worked hard to try to get to a point to where we did something substantive on behalf of the state of Montana. We didn't get everything we wanted every day, but we always presumed the good faith of one another. And I think every one of those people who served in those other offices would say it was a glorious moment for productive government in the state of Montana.
Governor, you mentioned the sales tax, and this is the time when I really understood that you were a man of character and integrity. Let me tell you this story, and I want to see if you even remember it. The biggest bill in the session when I was a young pup legislator was you getting the sales tax on to the ballot for a vote of the people. That was by far the biggest bill of the session of, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 bills. I had a little tiny bill about some subdivision reform, and it was just a pimple compared to the sales tax bill. And you were having a hard time getting 51 votes to get your bill through the House. And the Speaker of the House went to you and said, Governor, I will get you your 51 votes if you veto this subdivision bill of fags. And you, this is, I wasn't in the room, but I heard you look him in the eye and said, Mr. Speaker, I believe that every bill should rise or fall on its own merits. And I'm going to do everything I can, but I'm not going to take your deal. And when I heard that, I just thought, you know, 19 out of 20 people would have said, yes, I'll take that deal, because your sub or your sales tax bill was the big deal. And that's when I really was convinced you were a person of integrity. Do you even recall that happening?
Oh, I remember with absolute clarity, Russ. I don't know if it was your first or second term. I think it was your second term, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it was.
It was a matter of significant and substantial importance to you. It was an idea that had its own impetus and power. It was the right thing to do. You had worked it hard. It presented it before both bodies, both houses of the legislature. It had passed. And there was a minority of people who did not want to see it become law. But, you know, Russ, that's the way we did things when I was serving in that office was – there were no trade-offs. There
right.
were no agreements. There were just the power of ideas. And if your idea was strong enough and powerful enough and made enough sense that it essentially carried its own weight, then that's how we dealt with it. In the time that I was there in the governor's office, there were only 5 vetoes in that entire 8-year period of time. And that's because we tried to work with one another. And we listened hard to one another, and we tried to, as Mike Mansfield used to say, accommodate as best we could the desires and the beliefs of those people we lived with. We recognized we weren't going to get everything every day our way, but that we could accomplish things that moved society forward, moved the state forward on an incremental basis, and continue to work with each other. If you can't work with each other, you can't talk with each other, reason with each other, and can be considerate of other people's thoughts, you can't expect that a democracy will work. A Republican representative form of government won't work. So that was a sterling example of how it was supposed to work. And I had no pause at all. You were correct in your expectations. You'd worked it hard. You were entitled to see it passed. And frankly, I didn't want to be involved in a process where I had to keep track of agreements that were made about one person's legislation when it was opposed to another person's legislation if it had passed both houses of the legislature.
Well, I have to tell you, Governor, it just shows your character to have that belief. And it really segues into what I want to talk about next, which is the state of politics today and the change. Before we do that, we have a news break. We'll be right back with Governor Mark Roscoe.
Montana agriculture is unique, to say the least. Our landscapes and soil types are different. Our weather can be strange and unforgiving. The size of operations and distances between them can be vast. That is why a true Montana ag lender is so important. At Stockman Bank, we have a proven track record of over 65 years in Montana agriculture. Our commitment is unwavering, and our ag expertise is second to none. Contact us today and see why Stockman Bank is Montana's ag leader. Member FDIC.
Montana's Electric Cooperatives Association knows co-op members across the state rely on Rural Montana Magazine for everything from energy news to recipes, and they do their best to deliver it to you on time each month. However, due to circumstances beyond control, namely nationwide staffing shortages and a decreased paper supply, the January issue of Rural Montana will be delivered a week or two later than usual. Thanks for your patience. It'll be worth the wait. A message from your Montana Electric Cooperative. They do more than keep the lights on for you.
It's called a whiteout, and it requires caution. Snowplows create a cloud of snow that limits visibility for drivers following too closely, oncoming vehicles, and sometimes even the snowplow driver. Be patient. Plows maneuver slowly to clear the roads. As you approach a snowplow, slow down and give the plow driver room to work. Remember, don't crowd the plow. A safety message from AAA Mountain West and the Montana Department of Transportation.
Welcome back to Voices of Montana. We're here with Governor Mark Roscoe. Governor, I have thoroughly enjoyed our visit. Unfortunately, we only have a few minutes left, and your last point really segued into something I wanted to talk with you about. I know you recently spoke to the Montana Taxpayers Association about what's going on in today's political arena and some of the concerns you have. Could you kind of encapsulate that for a minute for our viewers?
Well, I think I'd be happy to. If you can't talk to each other and you can't reason with one another and you can't listen to one another, you can't expect that a democratic government, a Republican form of government based on representatives working in a democracy can survive. It's totally dependent upon the communications and the capacity for people to listen, to study hard, to presume the best of other people, until there's proof otherwise, to try and get something accomplished. Mike Mansfield used to say that getting one inch was better than nothing at all. And, you know, frankly, with the intervention of the Internet, as marvelous as it is in so many different ways, our communications are now edgy. They're instantaneous. The entire atmosphere is filled with noise. It's very difficult for people to follow what's going on. And as a consequence, our politics has gotten mean and angry and bitter. And the slanderous attacks that take place during campaigns and afterwards, the commentaries that are offered by the political hucksters on cable channels and on blogs, it's creating an atmosphere, Russ, that's poisonous. And it is separating us. It's tearing us apart, the social fabric of Montana and the nation. And it's bringing a sense of impotence and incapability and gridlock to our political system. And if we don't fix it, if we as citizens don't demand more and try to change the system and its institutions back to the productive models that we have utilized throughout the course of our history, we're going to deeply regret it, and we're going to place the democracy at risk of even surviving. You know, there was a Washington Post poll just days ago that revealed that 34% of the American people think that violence against the government that is appropriate on occasion, that taking actions like January 6th are appropriate. That's a third of the people of our nation. That just is so much higher than it ever was before, even though it's been asked before. And as a consequence, I think it's a reflective sign of where we are as a society. So my great hope is that we can rediscover the ways that we have been successfully doing business in Montana for many generations before this last decade or decade and a half, where we've devolved into a system that is not productive, is bitter and angry and threatening the very fabric of our democracy.
And so is it as simple and as difficult as disagree without being disagreeable, understanding that compromise is not a dirty word, and just treating other people like you would want to be treated?
It absolutely is, Russ. But I think we've slipped into this unconsciously almost. With the Internet forms of communication, They're antiseptic, they're sanitary, they're mean. People send off stuff that they don't that they regret ultimately. I think we've got to change some, get back to public hearings, to listening to one another, to presuming the best of the opposition, even if we disagree. So there are so many different things that can be done institutionally, even considering doing nonpartisan primary campaigns, which would eliminate some of the cutting.
Governor, I'm sorry to cut you off. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I just want to say God bless you and Teresa and your kids and your grandkids, and let's have you on again sometime in the near future.